Right, well, welcome this morning. We are going to be in Ezekiel, part of the Bible that maybe we're not as familiar with, in the midst of a series that we've entitled A New Heart. A lot of takeaways here as we think about what was happening in Israel at this time and what's happening in the church, and so much that I think God wants to teach us during this time. And I'm praying for me and for you that it'll be a time of renewal. It'll be a time when hard hearts and cloudy eyes are renewed, and we have a fresh vision of who God is and who we are in relationship to Him. So Ezekiel, we're going to be in chapter 4. It's a 48-chapter book. We said we're not going to be going through verse by verse, but we're going to be tracing some of the major movements. And today we're going to be in Ezekiel 4 and 5. If you want to join me there. Have you ever been in an influential position or had a responsibility over a group of people and you let them down or you led them astray in some way? I had an experience in high school. Of course, I think about it different times in sports where I feel like maybe I let my teammates down. But I'm thinking of one episode in high school where I got in trouble, went to a small Christian high school, 40 students in my high school. I was a senior, supposed to be an example, and got in trouble. And I remember, I think about it still to this day, like the impact of my actions and how that could have deterred someone else from the faith, caused somebody to view me differently, brought some type of reproach on the gospel itself. So maybe there's an episode like that for you. You can start to think in those terms. Certainly, we have a case study here in Israel. I mean, Israel was given this really prominent position. I mean, they were to be God's people in the world, and we're going to kind of unpack what that means. Ezekiel sort of addresses that with the people here. And of course, Israel blew it, didn't they? They didn't represent God. Matter of fact, they did just the opposite. And I think we need to think, too, as the church, that we have been given a particular responsibility to represent God in the world. We ought to feel the weight of that. Anthony prayed it this morning, kind of reflecting on that very theme, that we would be God's representatives and we would represent Him well. So this is the domain in which we want to go, and I want us to feel the weight of gospel responsibility, sacred responsibility that has been entrusted to us. We've received a glorious, gracious salvation through Christ, but we've also been given a high calling, and we need to face that here this morning. The theme here in the opening section of Ezekiel is judgment. He does turn a corner at a certain point. There is much grace to be found here in the book of Ezekiel, but certainly we're going to get a heavy dose of God's holiness and human sinfulness. All right, Ezekiel, as we looked at last week, was a Jewish refugee or exile. He was displaced from his country of origin there in Israel, and he was living in Babylon with other refugees. And God appeared to Ezekiel on his 30th birthday and commissioned him to a unique task. And I think it is significant that God appeared to him on his 30th birthday. Ezekiel was from a priestly family, and you could start serving as a priest at the age of 30. And so this is the day on which he could have been commissioned as a priest if he was back in Israel. And God commissions him as a priest, even in Babylon. Calls on him to do what a priest does, right? To mediate between God and the people. Ezekiel was called to be God's spokesperson. It was not going to be an easy task. It is not an easy task to be God's ambassadors. Matter of fact, Ezekiel was told the people are not going to listen to you. How's that for an encouraging commission, right? I want you to do this. I want you to say this, and no one's going to pay any attention. This was Ezekiel's task, to serve God faithfully, regardless of outcomes. So he first of all helps them understand the severity and the certainty of judgment. He's helping them understand what's happening with exile, what God is doing in all of this, and then why they've experienced God's judgment, why they're in exile. And I think that's really where I think there's some real payoff for us as the church to encounter and kind of take a good look in the mirror. But first, the certainty and severity of judgment. And Ezekiel, in a wonderful way, prophesied not only with his words, but with his actions. There's a lot of visuals going on here in Ezekiel. So let's pick up Ezekiel 4. There's three different signs, three different scenes that are laid out here for us to help us grasp the significance of God's judgment. Ezekiel 4, verse 1, and I will be reading out of the NIV this morning. "Now, son of man, take a block of clay, put it in front of you, and draw the city of Jerusalem on it. Then lay siege to it. Erect siege works against it. Build a ramp up to it. Set up camps against it, and put battering rams around it. Then take an iron pan, place it as an iron wall between you and the city, and turn your face toward it. It will be under siege, and you shall besiege it. This will be a sign to the people of Israel," a picture for them, right? So what I'm calling here the sign of the siege, this is the picture that he paints for them here in these opening verses. These exiles were holding out hope that Jerusalem could be spared and their fortunes could be reversed. I mean, many of these exiles had been carted off from Israel into Babylon, but Jerusalem was still standing. It had not fallen yet, and they were holding out hope that God would rescue them. And Ezekiel spends the first 7 years of his ministry convincing them that Jerusalem is going to fall. It is going to get worse before it gets better. God's judgment is coming in a full way against your sin. So Ezekiel was told to take a clay tablet. We might think of it maybe as a large sheet of paper, right? But they didn't have paper in that day, so they would write on clay tablets. And he was to take that and put it there in a prominent place amongst the various exiles. I have my own copy here of that clay tablet. All right, here's the model of the city of Jerusalem that he had written on that clay tablet. And then he put that there, and he was to build a siege around it. So you see the little sticks there, right? And he was to pretend like there was enemies. He got out all of his army guys, right, and set them all up, probably just rocks and sticks, right? He surrounded the city. That's what a siege is. You are surrounded. Nobody can get into the city, and nobody can get out of the city. And if that lasts for very long, it gets really ugly, all right? So they're completely strangled here by the enemy. And then God does something interesting. He says he wants him to take an iron pan. Abram's in the house. Abram, give that a good knock. Oh, it's pretty solid, isn't it? So God said, I want you to lay down, Ezekiel, next to the city. And I want you to put this pan as a wall between you and the city. That's a solid wall, right? And look towards the city. See, there's a barrier there between God and his people. He was not going to rescue them. He was not going to defeat those enemies. He was going to allow them to experience that siege. I mean, that's a serious picture that he paints for them to help them realize the seriousness of their situation. So a sign of the siege, a sign of the suffering. He also is told to do certain things to sort of demonstrate how bad it's going to be. And I'm not going to read this section in chapter 4. I'm going to summarize it for you, verses 4 through 17. But Ezekiel was told to lay on his side to graphically depict the suffering of the people. Matter of fact, he was to lay on his side, on one side, with his hands tied up there. He was to be bound, restricted, right? And that's the idea of siege again. He's restricted in his movements. He's having to lay on his side for 390 days. That's more than a year, right? And he was to lay there one day for every year of their sin. 390 days for the 390 years that Israel had rebelled against God. And I don't think he laid there 24/7. I think what happened is he would lay there, come out there early in the morning and have somebody tie him up with ropes, and he'd lay down there next to the city and he'd lay there all day and he'd come back the next day and he'd do the same thing, right? So every day he kept coming back to show the extent of the suffering that God was going to bring, the extent of his judgment. He was to fill a storage jar with a small amount of basic food, some beans and millet and just like potato, rice type of stuff, you know, just not real exciting, no sugar, nothing like that, right? 8 ounces a day he was to take. He was to live on 8 ounces a day. So that's about what I've got in this bag, 8 ounces of rice. And he was to, that was all he got, and he'd kind of portion it out and eat a little bit at different times throughout the day. That's the only food he had for over a year. Right? And then it gets really gross, okay? I'm just going to warn you. Ezekiel's pretty graphic, all right? He's told to make his bread, to mix up his flour and make his bread and cook it over excrement, dung, poop. We just said poop in church, okay? This is so gross. Why would anybody cook something over poop, over dried poop? Because there was nothing else, right? The city is under siege. There's no branches. There's no sticks. All the trees are torn down. And they're so desperate. And it's not only gross, but it was shameful. I mean, this was contrary to God's law, the law of Moses. God had set up these clear ideas of clean and unclean, and his people were to live as clean people, but they were so desperate, and they were unclean before God because of their sin. So this is the picture. Ezekiel wanted them to see and to smell the desperate suffering of the people. Can you imagine if you only ate this much for a year, every day for a year? I mean, Ezekiel was probably pretty skinny, right? The bones are poking out. His eyes were probably kind of sunken. I mean, he was not getting a healthy diet. And this was a picture of the suffering of God's people, the seriousness of sin, God's judgment. So the sign of the siege, the sign of the suffering, and what I'm calling the sign of the hair. Let's pick back up in chapter 5. Now, son of man, take a sharp sword and use it as a barber's razor to shave your head and your beard. Then take a set of scales and divide up the hair. When the days of your siege come to an end, burn a third of the hair inside the city. Take a third and strike it with the sword all around the city and scatter a third to the wind. For I will pursue them with drawn sword. But take a few hairs and tuck them away in the folds of your garment. Again, take a few of these and throw them into the fire and burn them up. A fire will spread from there to all Israel. So I'm not going to cut my hair today, and I don't have that much hair to cut, right? But I think Ezekiel had a lot of hair, and he had a really big beard probably. And so he's told to cut his hair, which, by the way, would be very shameful. We don't think about that. For us, it doesn't matter whether your hair is short or long. But for a Jewish person, especially a Jewish priest, to have a shaved head would have been shameful. So just that in itself. But he shaves his hair. I don't have any hair here, but I do have some paper shreddings. All right. So three piles. He was divided up into three piles. Look at all that little pieces of shredded paper, right? Think about all when you get your hair cut, all those little teeny pieces of hair. That represents all the people. All the people of Israel are represented in these piles. And he was to take one pile and put it in the city of Jerusalem. And he was to burn that pile. Right? Because those people were going to die of famine, lack of food, and disease. He was to take another pile and he was to spread it outside of the city, and then he was to take his sword and chop, 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 chop. Some people would not die of famine, but they would die by the sword at the hand of the enemy, right? And then a third, the last third, he was to take, and actually he was to take a little bit of this, put it in his pocket, right? And then the rest of it he was to take and throw it up in the air and let the wind take it away, right? That represents a group of people that would be scattered all over the world. But this little group of people right here was a remnant. I think this is Ezekiel and his fellow exiles that God was going to take care of and preserve. In the midst of God's judgment, we have this wonderful picture of God's grace. He could have destroyed everyone for their sin, but God chose to preserve his people. And we see, of course, as we look ahead into the New Testament and the work of Christ, we see that Jesus actually took our sin on his body as he went to the tree, went to the cross, so that he took the penalty. I mean, we all deserve God's judgment. This big mess of paper up here, right? We all deserve God's judgment. That's the natural consequence of our sin, because God is so holy and because we are so rebellious. But God has made a way for us to be saved. So a great reminder here of God's grace in the midst of his judgment. If you don't know Christ, if you're living apart from Jesus, if you've not experienced his forgiveness, if you've never shared in the atoning of sin, then you are deserving of God's judgment. We all are. I plead with you, if you've never recognized your sin and turned to God for his grace, that you don't delay. He's desiring to extend his forgiveness and grace to all who will come to him through Christ. So the certainty and severity of judgment that is unpacked here by Ezekiel. And then the cause of judgment. This is where I want to focus. I think here's kind of the payoff for us this morning. Chapter 5, verse 5. Ezekiel begins to unpack why they were in exile, why God had come against them in judgment. Ezekiel 5:5, this is what the sovereign Lord says, this is Jerusalem, which I have set in the center of the nations with countries all around her, yet in her wickedness she has rebelled against my laws and decrees more than the nations and countries around her. She has rejected my laws and has not followed my decrees. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says, you have been more unruly than the nations around you and have not followed my decrees or kept my laws. You have not even conformed to the standards of the nations around you. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I myself am against you, Jerusalem, and I will inflict punishment on you in the sight of the nations because of all your detestable idols. I will do to you what I have never done before and will never do again. Therefore, in your midst, parents will eat their children, and children will eat their parents. I will inflict punishment on you and will scatter all your survivors to the winds. Therefore, as surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, because you have defiled my sanctuary with all your vile images and detestable practices, I myself will shave you. I will not look on you with pity or spare you. A third of your people will die of the plague or perish by famine inside you. A third will fall by the sword outside your walls. And a third I will scatter to the winds and pursue with drawn sword. Then my anger will cease, and my wrath against them will subside, and I will be avenged. And when I have spent my wrath on them, they will know that I, the Lord, have spoken in my zeal. So here's what I want us to grasp here this morning as we think about why God brought about this judgment on Israel. We are called to live as God's distinct people in the world. We are called to live as God's distinct people in the world. Notice verse 5. This is what the sovereign Lord says. This is Jerusalem, which I have set in the center of the nations with countries all around her. God established Israel at the crossroads of civilization. It's a small little country there in the Middle East, but it has been a country that has been hotly contested for centuries. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but part of its geography, it's put right there in the center of things in the Middle East. One of my favorite sites in Israel was the city of Megiddo. You have to know when you go to Israel, you encounter a lot of what are called tells. Tells are hills. And the reason they're hills is because that's where cities used to be. And when a city would be destroyed, they would level things and rebuild on top of it. And so you ended up that cities were usually already on a high place, but by the time they were destroyed and rebuilt several times, things just kept getting higher. And so you have these little bumps that constitute those city locations. And Megiddo's really interesting. Megiddo, they've discovered over 26 distinct layers of civilization. And the implication is that that city had been fought over and destroyed and rebuilt at least 26 different times. It's on the Via Maris. It's on a major ancient highway along the Mediterranean, leading from Egypt in the south to Assyria, Babylon in the north. So, like, this was this is major trade routes. If you controlled these trade routes, you controlled commerce. And so God put them right there in the middle. And the idea was that they were to be a lighthouse in a sea of darkness. They were to be a symbol of peace and flourishing in the midst of a violent, sin-cursed world. They were to be a beacon of hope in the midst of fear and superstition in the nations around them. God had determined this even from the time of Abraham. Genesis 12, speaking to Abraham, God says, "I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." God's intent was always to make Israel a city on a hill. There's a company, a local company called Service Professor. They're a local heating and cooling company. They're a sponsor for the Thornapple Valley Baseball League. And several years ago, they paid extra for some advertising. And on the back of one of the dugouts, they put their big company advertisement. It happened to be right there on Thornapple River Drive, super prominent, about 30 feet from the road. And if you know anything about Service Professor, which I did not, they have like the brightest trucks in the world, like this mustard yellow. And this was plastered across the whole back of that dugout, and they got people complaining. They said, "That is such an eyesore over there." And sadly, they had to take it down. I felt really bad for Service Professor. People want to control things that aren't their property. Now, that's a whole other sermon, isn't it? Okay. Anyways, it's always stuck in my mind. This has been several years ago. I've never done any business with Service Professor, but every time I see that truck, I'm like, that's it. That's the company right there. And it's just because of the brightness of their advertisement, right? The yellow and the red. Now, we ought to stand out. Not because our church is painted a funny color, okay? Or not because we're technologically backward like the Amish. But make no mistake, we ought to be very distinct. God's intent for us is to be very distinct. We shouldn't be distinct because we're argumentative or angry. But we should stand out because of our integrity, because of our love, because of our unconditional commitment to one another, because of the way we treat each other, because of our business ethics, right? The list could go on and on. Now, I realize we're talking here about Israel and God's purpose for Israel and how God put them in the center of the nations, but I'm going to suggest to you that God has joined us in a common mission with Israel. Now, Israel and the church are two different entities. That's a whole different sermon. But God's joined us in a common mission. We can look at numerous New Testament passages where God says the same thing about the church. Right, here's one. Titus 2:10, not pilfering, not stealing, but showing all good faith so that in everything they may adorn the doctrine of God our Savior. Right? Make it beautiful, dress it up, present it well, represent Christ well in a way that reflects his glory and his beauty. And so that's how we're to live. 1 Peter 2:12, live such good lives among the pagans. By the way, that word good doesn't mean just morally good. It means beautiful, notable, winsome. We ought to just be radical in doing selfless things. Not just bare minimum moral conformity, but good deeds. We ought to be known for being generous and selfless. So live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. And here, of course, are the words of our Savior. Oh, looks like I scanned to get me back on Matthew 5 if you can. Somebody back there. Jesus taught about this very clearly there, didn't he? You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. See, God wants us to stand out, to be distinct. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. So we're called to be that city on a hill, a model for the nations, an alternative to what they experience in the brokenness of a sin-cursed world. We should be distinctive, again, in our unity, our treatment of one another, and our sexuality, our expression of our sexuality, our generosity, our use of finances, our business ethics, our entertainment choices. I ask you here, as we just think about God's purpose for Israel and for the church, are you distinct? Do you stand out? Have you grappled with the fact that this is part of what it is to follow Jesus? That you'll be out of sync with the culture, that you're to be different than the society. We've been saved from something. We've been saved from sin. We've been saved from eternal death. We've been saved from hell. We often focus on that when we think about the gospel, but we've also been saved for something. We've been saved to something, and that is to serve God, to be his ambassadors in the world, his representatives. Secondly, when we fail to live up to even the moral standards of the world, we undermine our mission and incur God's judgment. So we're called to be God's distinct people in the world, and when we fail to live up even to the moral standards of the world, we undermine our mission and incur God's judgment. Israel rebelled against God's rules. They did not live as God's distinct people. And actually, the text says here that they became even more wicked. Not only did they not stand out from the surrounding nations like they were supposed to, they actually became more wicked than the surrounding nations. That even the surrounding nations looked at them and said, "Oh, my word, we wouldn't even do that." Here's the indictment. Not only weren't they a city on a hill, they were a city in a pit. They brought reproach on the name of God. We could go through and look at some of the specifics. They were marked by rebellion in verse 6. They were marked by wickedness, verse 6. They were unruly or turbulent. There's one of the great images. Verse 7 describes the swell of a restless crowd or a rioting mob. Instead of being the orderly people of God, they were revolting. They were casting off restraint. They were doing their own thing, refusing to abide by any guidelines, refusing to be governed by God's standards and his gracious will. They had committed abominations. They worshipped detestable idols and defiled God's sanctuary with all their vile images and detestable practices, verses 9 through 11. By the way, we sometimes look at that idolatry piece and sort of make a disconnect, all those pagan people worshiping objects of stone and wood. Paul brings it across for us in the New Testament writings, and he says, idolatry is greed. Ephesians and Colossians. Idolatry is greed. It's just an attempt to try to sort of get more than maybe you currently have. That's why they worship these other gods and goddesses who would bless them or prosper their business or allow them to have more children or whatever it might be. And he said, when we give our heart to other things and other pursuits, your job, while a good thing and a way to serve others, can be a source of idolatry in your life. If that becomes your goal and your passion to accumulate and amass, well, these are all the kinds of things that characterized Israel and caused them to lose their distinctiveness. And it's rooted here in God's jealousy. Verse 13, then my anger will cease and my wrath against them will subside and I will be avenged. And when I have spent my wrath on them, they will know that I, the Lord, have spoken in my zeal or in my jealousy. We don't often think of that as a good thing, right? But God is not jealous out of anger or envy. He's jealous. It's a relational word. He has taken us to himself as a bride, and he's fiercely passionate about that relationship. He tolerates no rivals, right? As any good husband would not think kindly of his wife flirting with another man, right? You say that's a good thing, and it's good for God to be jealous over his people. He's brought us into a covenant relationship, and it's exclusive. And when we give our heart to other things, we violate that. Demas here, 2 Timothy chapter 4. Demas was one of Paul's co-workers, but it says that for Demas, because he loved this world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. So it doesn't mean that Demas like loved the trees and the streams and just liked the outdoors, the physical planet. We love God's creation, of course. But it's speaking here, this idea of the world is speaking of the world's value system, the world's godless value system and its orientation towards selfishness, its orientation against God. And Demas was drawn to that. And that's a tendency, isn't it? I mean, we have these predominant messages in our culture about what it is to live a successful life and what security means, what financial security means, what success means in the business world. And there's all these messages that are bombarding us. And if we're not careful, we are conformed to the world, or we're pressed into the mold of the world. Romans 12 says, don't be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. It takes discipline and rigorous effort to continue to resist other lovers, if I put it that way, right? To maintain fidelity to God and to God alone. This is a message that certainly we need to hear, particularly in the West. John Hilber, who wrote an excellent commentary on Ezekiel, said it is tragically the case, particularly in the United States, that Christians have become so syncretized to the culture around them that the distinction is hardly noticeable. Whether it is failure to love one another, consumerism, or grasping for social and political power. I think there's a number of ways we can lose our distinctiveness. We can lose it morally if we don't abide by God's distinctive standards for sexuality and truthfulness. And we can certainly lose it relationally by disunity. We can undermine, discredit the gospel, right? Cause people to look on us and shake their heads. I ask, is your attitude distinct when you face disappointment or mistreatment? Are you distinct in your music choices, in how you dress, in how you speak? Is your speech savory, right? Is it winsome? Does it leave people feeling encouraged and hopeful, or are you always down, right? Here's one for me. I can tend to just talk down. My mind gets going, I get discouraged, and I can start plotting worst-case scenarios, and I'm 5 years out, and the world has crashed, and I have to guard my heart and my mind. I ought to have a perspective. Doesn't mean I have a plastic smile all the time, but I ought to have this abiding, underlying hope that characterizes me, right? Am I distinct in that way? In the midst of a crazy culture and all the different things that are going on, we have to ask ourselves, am I living as the distinct people of God? And understanding that when we don't live as the distinct people of God, when we compromise and are conformed to the world, we compromise our mission and we incur God's wrath. This is serious business to God, that we are his covenant people and that we fulfill the calling that he has given us. I had this in there. I think it's still there. I want to show a little video here. Casting Crowns did a little music video on a song called The City on the Hill. And it focuses specifically on how we can lose our testimony and our distinctiveness by disunity. But I think as we think in the context of Ezekiel 4 and 5, just to think broadly about how we can better be the city on a hill. Maybe there's some specific things you just look at and say, you know, this is the world's way of thinking, or this is the world's way of acting, and I've become syncretized to my culture in this area. And maybe there's some opportunity, just even as you hear this song, to reflect on that. We'll kind of close with this, Craig.